Today is Monday, May 28th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. It is 5:07 and time for another relatively full hour of independent news. Our headlines today will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this, plus your weekday weather forecast, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now, for your UBC campus and local headlines.
Vancouver parks will soon be brimming with farmers' markets, orchards, and hosting composting classes if commissioners pass a motion on Monday night on food policy. This motion will create the Local Food Assets Task Force. The task force will be comprised of two park board commissioners and staff, city staff, as well as members of various neighborhood food networks across the city, who already organize pop-up farmers' markets on city property. There are currently 14 community gardens, 3 fruit orchards, and temporary farmers' markets utilizing city-owned land. The task force will help identify ways to expand on these programs, as well as encourage new initiatives. Aaron Jasper, Park Board Vice Chair, said that the Local Food Assets Task Force is being created to support Vancouver's goals to become the world's greenest city by 2020. He commented on the current neighborhood food networks, saying that these networks, quote, teach classes on everything from how to keep a compost to grow your own food. But one of the challenges of these neighborhood food networks is they don't have a place to do their work, end quote. Also adding that the park community centers that can be used to host such events need more space. Jasper insisted that city resources will not be put under greater financial pressure with the new mandate, citing the success of the Fruit Orchard program, which partners with elementary schools to help care for the plots. Mosquito devices that are said to deter young people were turned back on at Kerrisdale Annex last week, not long after a vandalism incident on this playground in early May that caused $3,000 in damage. The Vancouver School District also plans to turn devices on at Henderson Elementary after a fire over the Victoria Day long weekend caused roughly $15,000 in damage. Vandals broke a window and tossed a small incendiary device into a classroom. School District spokesman Kurt Heinrich said there isn't a direct connection between the vandalism at Henderson and the lack of a mosquito device, as the police didn't catch the vandals. But the district expects to reactivate more devices at other school sites in the next few weeks following discussion with school communities and signs going up, according to Heinrich. 33 mosquito units, which emit an annoying sound at a frequency heard at almost exclusively by young people were installed at 19 schools, school board sites to crack down on vandalism and loitering. A decision on whether to scrap them or plug them back in wasn't expected until June, whilst district staff gathered more information about health and legal concerns. Heinrich said district management decided to look at reconnecting the mosquito devices at additional school sites other than Kerrisdale Annex earlier this week in light of the Henderson fire. David Ebby, executive director of the BC Civil Liberties Association, is disappointed at the district's decision. The association opposes mosquitoes on human rights grounds, mosquito devices, that is, on human rights grounds, arguing they target a specific age group unfairly.
As the debate over a provincial ban on cosmetic pesticides continues, First Call, a BC youth advocacy coalition, is urging the BC government to consider the effects of pesticides on children's health. Exposing children to toxins, quote, for the sake of killing dandelions, end quote, is unnecessary, said Adrian Montani, First Call's provincial coordinator. The statement comes 1 week after a special legislative committee put in place by Premier Christy Clark decided not to recommend a ban on cosmetics pesticide use in the province. Committee Chair Bill Bennett said that the evidence presented to the committee did not justify the provincial government enacting a ban where the federal government had not. But Montani countered that even if an education program could be put in place, the use of cosmetic pesticides is not worth putting children at risk. According to Dr. Bruce Lamphere of Simon Fraser University, children are more at risk for cancer and mental complications caused by cosmetic pesticides than adults because of the high growth rate of cells in children's bodies.
Richmond City Council says engineered crops and plants have no place in the gardens of Metro Vancouver. Councillors have voted unanimously to ban further genetically modified species from Richmond soil, although the ban is unenforceable because genetically engineered plants are regulated by the federal government, not local authorities. Activist Arzina Hamir fought for the Richmond decision and is pleased the city has joined Powell River, Salt Spring Island, and the Kootenay communities of Nelson, Rossland, and Caslow in banning scientifically altered crops. The ban comes just days after orchardists in BC's Okanagan region voiced concern about the possible arrival of genetically modified fruit trees. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency is considering an application to allow an engineered variety of apple, called the Arctic apple, that has a trait preventing the fruit from browning when cut. Growers fear customers will reject tinkered fruit, and the BC Fruit Growers Association has already passed a resolution opposing genetic modification, but supporters insist modified foods can solve many of the world's hunger problems through increased crop yields.
And those are our campus and local headlines for you, News 101. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay tuned for your local weather forecast as well as provincial and national headlines.
Larry Kwong became the first ethnic Chinese player in National Hockey League history in 1948 when he skated as a New York Ranger and was subsequently nicknamed the China Clipper. Although his career in the NHL would turn out to be short-lived, his passion for hockey carries on to this day. After a 20-year-long career as a player, he became a club team coach in Switzerland. Larry Kwong's breakthrough in hockey wasn't only the ethnic barrier for Chinese players, but more importantly, he also made the personal breakthrough of showing perseverance and dedication to the game.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Asian Heritage Month by CITR 101.9 FM.
What do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Claire Eagle, and you're listening to us broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building here at UBC. It's now time for your provincial and national headlines.
According to a national poll conducted by Harris Tasima and commissioned by CIBC, a total of 71% of British Columbians are carrying debt. Out of this, 37% of people in BC have a mortgage, while 41% carry credit card debt. 36% have a balance on their line of credit, while 5% are paying down a student loan. And 17% are paying off some other kind of loan. The poll finds the age group most likely to be in debt as adults ages 25 to 44, with about 82% in that demographic reporting indebtedness. After age 45, the likelihood of being in debt begins to decline. Only 18% of British Columbians interviewed reported being completely debt-free. A number of BC residents in debt is right on par with the national average of 71%. The margin of error for the 250 BC residents polled between March 22nd and April 2nd is plus or minus 6.2%, 19 times out of 20.
Striking CP Rail employees will likely be forced back to work by Thursday. Labor Minister Lisa Raitt, flanked by four other cabinet ministers, defended their tactic of legislating employees back to work today, saying that the train stoppages are hurting our national economy. According to Industry Minister Christian Paradis, the work stoppage is causing a daily loss in productivity of $30 to $50 million and is causing shippers to take their business south of the border. Wright says she wants to see trains rolling by Thursday. In the meantime, the back-to-work legislation will be pushed through the House. Once in effect, it will send union members back to work, extend their current contract until a new agreement is reached, and provide for government-appointed arbitration. The union is complaining that since the government announced their intention to legislate this disagreement away, the management at CP Rail has halted bargaining and that they are the latest victims in the federal government's attack on collective bargaining. Reduced pensions are believed to be a major disagreement point between the union and CP Rail management.
According to Vancouver Sun's fourth annual public servant salary database, the number of public servants making a six-figure salary has jumped significantly at health authorities. BC's five regional health authorities and the Provincial Health Services Authority, which oversees children's and women's healthcare, health center, and the BC Cancer Agency, saw a 13% increase in 2010 over 2009 in those being paid $100,000 or more. According to the Vancouver Sun, in the 4 years the newspaper has been tabulating the database, the number of public servants at health authorities making six-figure salaries has almost doubled from 1,655 in 2007 to 3,221 in 2010. Many of those at the $100,000 level at health authorities are nurses, physicians, pharmacists, managers, and radiation technologists. Health authorities say the key reasons for the increase in six-figure salaries are pay increases in contracts set provincially, such as for nurses, and because employees move up wage scales with experience. Northern Health Authority led the way with a 34% increase in six-figure salaries in 2010. A spokesman for the Fraser Health Authority, which saw a 22% increase, noted that the largest group of employees making more than $100,000 at 47% are unionized nurses. Nurses also account for the largest number of workers making six figures at the Vancouver Island Health Authority. Overall, across the public sector in BC, which also includes those working directly for ministries such as finance and forestry, the number of public servants making six-figure salaries remains about the same year over year, at more than 17,000. More information about this can be found in the Vancouver Sun's online database, which is BC's first searchable online database of public sector salaries.
Fears about the presence of an infectious virus have forced the Canadian Food Inspection Agency to quarantine a third BC salmon farm in 2 weeks. Mainstream Canada announced Friday afternoon that the agency had quarantined a second of its farms, the latest at Baudin Point off the west coast of Vancouver Island, north of Tofino, BC, after test results indicated a low positive result for the hematopoietic necrosis virus, known as IHN. However, even if a positive result comes back for the virus on their farm, Mainstream Canada still plans to harvest Atlantic salmon from Baudin Point because the fish will be ready for market and will not be harmful to humans. The first quarantine took place last week, also at a Mainstream farm north of Tofino, and forced the company to cull more than 560,000 juvenile Atlantic salmon. The other company to face a quarantine over the possible presence of the virus was Grieg Seafood, which also announced Friday afternoon that independent laboratory tests for IHN at a farm on the Sunshine Coast have now come back negative. According to the Food Inspection Agency, the virus does not pose a risk to human health and is found in wild fish in the Pacific. According to the agency, the virus is spread by contaminated equipment and contaminated water, and while there are no treatments available, vaccines are available to prevent the disease. Mary Ellen Walling, Executive Director of the BC Salmon Farmers Association, said test results for IHN have come back negative for 30 salmon farms, and another 21 samples are awaiting processing. She said the Department of Fisheries and Oceans have also sampled farms as part of its routine testing, and these samples came back as negative as well. According to BC's Ministry of Environment, the province's salmon farming industry is the fourth largest producer of farmed salmon in the world, and in 2009, 18 companies operate on 131 sites. 94% of the salmon farmed in the province are Atlantic salmon, with an estimated value of $470 million, while the remaining 6% are made up of Pacific salmon.
On a similar note, a unique relationship meant to reduce conflict between environmental groups and British Columbia's largest salmon farming company has fallen apart. The Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform and Marine Harvest Canada confirmed on Saturday that the project, known as the Framework for Dialogue, is officially over. When it was signed on January 12, 2006, the Framework for Dialogue was included nine environmental organizations and First Nations, as well as Marine Harvest. Participants agreed to focus on the industry's environmental, social, and economic factors, reduce conflict, and change practices when information showed there was an impact on the environment and wild salmon. But in recent years, the membership dropped to just four environmental groups, including the David Suzuki Foundation, Georgia Strait Alliance, Living Ocean Society, T. Buck Suzuki Foundation, as well as Marine Harvest. It appears the two sides could not agree on research related to sea lice and closed containment farming. What remains unclear now is whether or not more salmon is coming to the often testy and confrontational debate over salmon farming. According to the website, Marine Harvest produces about 40,000 tons of Atlantic salmon in BC annually.
The BC government is shifting gears on the Air Care program with a plan to phase out the tailpipe testing of light cars and trucks at the end of 2014 in favor of focusing on heavy-duty diesel vehicles. Environment Minister Terry Lake said newer cars run much cleaner than the vehicles being made when the Air Care testing programs began in Vancouver and the Fraser Valley in 1992. Lake said the Transportation and Environment Ministries will work to identify other classes of vehicles that haven't been covered by AirCare and find ways to reduce their emissions. Drivers of new cars currently pay $46 to have their vehicles tested by AirCare every 2 years, while owners of older versions pay $23 each year. The government says the two-year fee will be reduced in 2014 to make it fair for drivers needing an inspection in the final year of the program. Lake calls the fees a significant cost to families. The BC Government and Service Employees Union, which represents 114 workers at air care stations, said the government's decision on air care will lead to more pollution and fewer jobs. NDP leader Thomas Mulcair will use his upcoming tour of the Alberta oil sands to promote Quebec's model of sustainable development for the whole country. Says Mulcair, a former Quebec environment minister, quote, "It's a vision to include economic, social, and environmental aspects every time the government takes a decision. The legislation I brought forward in Quebec was a model in North America for sustainable development." Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall said Mulcair's proposal could significantly damage the job-creating potential of the oil sands or any other industry. For now, Mulcair will only spend Thursday in Alberta, meeting Fort McMurray Mayor Melissa Blake, touring a Suncor oil sands facility, and heading to Edmonton to meet with the Deputy Premier Thomas Lukaszczyk. Alberta Premier Alison Redford won't meet Mulcair. Mulcair's relationship with Western premiers in general has suffered recently. He dismissed them as so-called messengers for Prime Minister Stephen Harper and mused about the so-called Dutch disease from oil sands development in Alberta allegedly hurting manufacturing in Ontario and Quebec. Mulcair insists he's not worried those comments will be fodder for Wall, Redford, and BC Premier Christy Clark when they meet in Edmonton on Tuesday. And those were your provincial and national headlines for News 101. We now go to our health segment with correspondent Sharon Hundel and her team.
Welcome to your weekly health beat on CITR 101.9 FM. It's Dietitian Intuition,
your source for precise nutrition advice. What are you going to hear?
We'll cover everything. We'll bust nutrition myths, give tips, do book reviews as well as interviews, you name it. And now here are your dietetic students, Andrea, Jessica, and Sharon, for this week's segment.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in again. Since this is Celiac Awareness Month, we thought it would be great to bust some myths around celiac disease, and it's getting a lot of media attention right now. So I'm going to explain to you how this affects your body. Basically, a good question to ask is, what is the difference between a person who has celiac disease versus a person who has a wheat allergy? Basically, a person with celiac disease may experience symptoms such as severe pain in their lower abdomen if they eat foods that contain a protein called gluten found in many grains, such as wheat, rye, and barley. So this discomfort is due to damage specifically in a person's small intestine when gluten comes into contact with it. Essentially, the body attacks the individual's small intestine through a type of immune response, making celiac disease come under an umbrella of diseases called autoimmune diseases. So Andrea, I'm going to pass it off to you now.
Okay, so I'll just give you a quick explanation of what a wheat allergy is. So a wheat allergy occurs in some people due to their body recognizing wheat proteins as potentially harmful, which can launch a cascade of actions called an allergic response. An allergic response can spread across one's entire body and can either take time to develop or come on fast. And symptoms can also vary, ranging from mild, such as a rash or sneezing, to severe and even death. Now, why should we care? Nearly one out of every 133 people suffer from celiac disease, and this is according to a new study by the University of Maryland Center for Celiac Research in Baltimore. The research says that celiac disease is almost two times as common as Crohn's disease and cystic fibrosis combined. Wheat is one of the eight most common food allergies in the United States, and about 0.5% of children have a wheat allergy. The good news, though, is that it's not as common for adults and that most children end up outgrowing allergies by adolescence. So, for example, 29% of us will outgrow wheat allergies by age 4, and 65% of us will outgrow them by age 12. And now I'm going to pass it off to Jess, who will give you some practical tips on how to incorporate gluten-free food into your life.
Thank you, Andrea. So we have a couple tips for you for making gluten-free healthy and easy. There are a lot of other grain options besides wheat that you could try out. Teff, sorghum, millet, wild rice, quinoa, amaranth, and buckwheat. Even though there is wheat in the name, it's actually not wheat. So when you're in the supermarket, choose gluten-free items such as gluten-free pastas and breads that list the ingredient as whole grain first. So this way you're taking advantage of all the whole grain has to offer, such as fiber, which North Americans are very much lacking in their diets. If you want to learn more about living gluten-free, you can always visit glutenfreedietitian.com for more information. This is a dietitian who specializes in gluten-free living. There's also other dietitians that specialize in this, so just Google gluten-free and dietitian. And that's it for this week.
Thanks for tuning in again this week.
If you missed us, go to CITR.ca to listen to our podcast or follow us on Twitter at CITR Dietitians for more dietitian intuition. Until next time, stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
Thanks to Sharon and her team for her insights on health. We now go to our weekly weather forecast with Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club.
Hi, Phil.
Hey. Thanks, Claire. Good evening, listeners. Today is Monday the 28th, the last Monday of May 2012, wrapping up this delightful month in which we saw some exciting temperature spikes in the 20s and plenty of sunshine here in Vancouver. We're going to get a bit more sunshine tomorrow, Tuesday, before diving into a streak of cloudy days with decent chances of precipitation. Temperatures are expected to hover around a mild 13, 14 degrees, fortunately, but visibility will be reduced at night and early morning by fog formation, as well as the aforementioned rain. So great. Now here's your five-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, overcast with a 50% chance of rain, low of 12. Tomorrow, Tuesday, we're expecting partly cloudy weather, so a little bit of sunshine in there. High of 14, low of 12. Wednesday, 20% chance of rain in the evening and 50% chance at night, anticipating about 10 millimeters. High of 14, low of 13. Thursday, 50% chance of rain, heavy fog at night. High of 15, low of 11. And Friday, we anticipate overcast with a 70% chance of rain at night. High of 18, low of 11. So that's your five-day weekday weather forecast for UBC campus, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 16 degrees on the UBC campus. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Great. Thanks, as always, Phil, for your insights into the weather. And it was nice talking to you on this last Monday of May. It's very sad when you say it like that.
Thanks, Claire.
But now we go to a quick break. But please do stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca.
On Friday, June 1st, for 24 hours, CITR is going to paint the airwaves rainbow. Starting at 6 a.m., CITR programmers will be producing an entire day of queer content in celebration of Pride season around the world, delivering messages of hope, fun, warning, and whimsy that may also include offensive language, sexual themes, and excessive on-air nudity. Listener discretion is advised, while indiscretions are strongly encouraged. Love food this much? Then you need to be at Eat Vancouver in the BC Play Stadium June 1st through 3rd. Eat Vancouver is the ultimate food and cooking expo, featuring celebrity chefs, hundreds of retailers, and of course a vast array of amazing food and drink to help you discover your next culinary destination. For more information and to book your tickets at a $2 discount, go to eat-vancouver.com. Sponsored by CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. I'm Claire Eagle. My co-host here is Chirag Mahajan, and we now go to Democracy Now! For some news on the student protest in Quebec.
Now, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté.
We turn now to the ongoing student strike in Quebec, where a protest that began over tuition fees has grown into a full-blown political crisis. The strike erupted 3 months ago after the provincial government announced a 75% tuition hike over the next 5 years. Students have responded with a sustained campaign of protests and class boycotts that has come to be known around the world as the Maple Spring. The protests have been daily and on some occasions have turned violent. Earlier this month, 11 people were hospitalized when police fired rubber bullets and tear gas at a crowd protesting the convention of the governing Liberal Party in Victoriaville. One demonstrator lost an eye and another suffered critical injuries. The dispute exploded last week after the Quebec government passed an emergency law known as Bill 78, which suspends the current academic term and requires demonstrators to inform police of any protest route involving 50 or more people. The bill threatens student associations with fines of up to $125,000 if they disobey or even fail to stop protests from occurring on campus. But the students have responded with their largest protest to date. On Tuesday, the strike's 100th day, an estimated crowd of up to 400,000 filled the streets of Montreal in defiance of the law. It was said to be the largest act of civil disobedience in Canadian history. The following day, another massive protest saw a harsh police response, with over 500 people arrested in Montreal and another 100 arrested in Quebec City.
The strike has received growing international attention as the standoff grows, striking a chord with young people across the globe amidst growing discontent over austerity measures, bleak economies, and crushing student debt. Solidarity demonstrations were held this week across Canada as well as in New York and Paris, with supporters donning the red felt square that has come to symbolize the Quebec student movement. For more, we're going to Montreal, where we're joined by two guests. Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois is the spokesperson for CLASS, the main coalition of student unions involved in the student strikes in Quebec, and Anna Kruzinski is assistant professor at the School of Community and Public Affairs at Concordia University in Montreal. She's been involved in the student strike as a member of the group Professors Against the Hike. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Gabrielle, we welcome you back. Talk about what happened this week. 400,000 people in the streets. Who were they? Close to 1,000 arrested. What are you calling for?
Well, like you said in your intro, last week we saw our government adopting a special law called Bill 78, who is really restrictive according to the right to protest. And we were, and this protest of March 22 was planned since a few weeks now. But the adoption of this special bill really motivated a lot of people more to come to the protest. And in fact, the objective of the law, according to the government, was to calm the confrontation in the streets of Montreal, was to stop the people from protesting. We had a congress at the coalition last weekend. We decided unanimously to defy the law and to hold our protest on March 22 without giving the route of the protest to the police forces, like the Bill 78 is asking us to do. And we were hoping for a massive act of civil disobedience, and that's exactly what happened. We saw maybe 400,000 people in the streets of Montreal, a lot of students, but for one time a lot also of citizens, teachers, people from all ages who were in the streets with us, not only to contest against this tuition increase, but also more specifically to contest the adoption of this special law.
I want to ask Anna Kruzinski. Now, this started out as a protest against a tuition increase, 75% over 5 years. But it seems now, with so many people in the streets and you have this emergency law that's attracting international attention, that this has grown much bigger. Can you talk about what's at stake here?
Sure. I mean, the tuition hike is part and parcel of a neoliberal agenda of this government. So it does. It's not isolated from other measures that aim to privatize public services. So we could talking about this notion of user fees for public services as opposed to free and accessible services through progressive taxation. So this is part of a larger issue. So this has been touching also health and hydro and other public services. So this has been going on for several several years, but what the student movement has managed to do is to bring this debate into the forefront, beyond the question of tuition fees. And this, we saw over the 3 months of the student movement, more and more community organizations, mainstream social movements, unions, professionals from all walks of life, citizens, ordinary folks, joining into the struggle. But when the government passed Bill 78 on May 18th, there was an explosion of support for the student movement, but also a real questioning of the legitimacy of this government that is trying to push through austerity measures that the majority of the population do not want to see. And this government is illegitimate and needs to take the back seat now. There's a clear movement, and people, we can see this actually happening in the last few days in many neighborhoods in Montreal, but also outside of Montreal in the regions, in the rural areas. There's been spontaneous demonstrations of elderly people, families, children with pots and pans doing spontaneous demonstrations in their neighborhood in support of the student movement against Bill 78. So this is becoming much bigger than what it was originally.
In fact, the adoption of the law was one of the things that helped the most our movement since the beginning. It drew so much support to our movement, and the objective of the law was to stop the movement. In fact, it had the exact opposite effect. We have seen more protests than ever, and the biggest protest since 100 days of strike.
Yep.
Now, Gabrielle, the Quebec government says that you have the lowest tuition in North America. They're asking that this increase be spread out over 5 years. What's your response to that? And what counter proposals have the students raised to cover up for what the government calls a funding shortfall that needs to be addressed?
Well, about our tuition, we are in fact very proud of having the lowest tuition fees in North America. We think that we have the chance in Quebec to have fought in the past to keep an accessible education system, which is based on two main pillars. The first one is the existence of the CEGEP, which are professional colleges that are free, and the second one is by keeping our tuition fees in the universities very low. And those two factors combined makes that we have the post-secondary frequentation rate, the best rate of post-secondary frequentation in Canada. We're talking about more than 10% over the Canadian average on this point. So we have if we follow the Canadian average of tuition fees, like the government is proposing, we will probably also follow the Canadian average of accessibility to education, which is not very good news, if you want my opinion. So our movement right now is a movement to defend this system that we have built in the past, that our parents have built in the past, by mobilizing. And the decision of the government is to try to destroy the very unique education system in Quebec to get closer to the one of USA and of the rest of Canada. And that's exactly what we are refusing as a generation with this strike.
Yeah, and we're at an intersection here. It's either we move toward a Scandinavian model of free education, or we move toward a U.S. model with high fees. So it's not about, it's. I would say to Canadians and to others elsewhere, wouldn't it be nice if fees were low everywhere, as opposed to saying we should have higher fees here in Quebec?
I want to ask you about the Canadian media's coverage of the Quebec student strike. The cover of this week's Maclean's Magazine, which is the Canadian equivalent of Time or Newsweek, reads, quote, "Quebec's new ruling class, how a group of entitled students went to war and shut down a province over $325. Gabrielle, can you respond?
Well, it's I found that pretty funny when I read the Maclean's newspaper. I think there is a very big misunderstanding of our fight in the rest of Canada. Yeah. I think a lot of groups in the rest of Canada see our protest as a spoiled children protesting, that like if Quebecers would always want more from the state without never giving nothing back. I think it's a lot of préjugé, and honestly, it's so big that I have difficulty to say exactly what the problem is with the media.
But I'd like to say something about that, actually, because if we look at how the media coverage happened here in Quebec at the beginning of the student movement, We had a similar discourse, perhaps a little less colorful, but a similar discourse in the mainstream media. But no one is talking anymore about spoiled children in Quebec. After 3 months of very articulate and very well thought out argumentation around the vision of our society, this is not about $325. This is about the privatization of our public services. It's the beginning of austerity measures or the continuation of austerity measures. And it's not about, it's not about spoiled children going off and taking advantage of their strike and going to Florida or whatever. This is what was said here in Quebec as well at the beginning of the strike. And I think that now the Canadian media and media elsewhere are waking up to what's going on here, and they're starting out where the Quebec media started out 3 months ago with the analysis of the movement. So I'm hoping that given the situation, that they will actually talk to us and see what is actually going on, and not be making these kinds of statements, which are truly false, and all they do is divide the population and create misinformation.
Now, for our radio audience, our guests are both wearing this red felt patch on their chest. Can you guys talk about what that patch signifies?
This symbol was first popularized in 2005, which was the last big student strike in Quebec against a cut of $103 million in the bursaries transferred into loans. So when we did this strike a few years ago, this red patch was born. We call it the Red Square because the students here are squarely in the red. So it's a symbol for student indebtedness. And when we started our strike a few months ago here in Quebec, well, we decided to renew this symbol, who has really become in the last months not only the symbol of the student movement, but the symbol of the contestation of the Liberal government, of the contestation of his austerity measures, of his measures of privatization of our public services. And anyone who comes to visit Montreal these days can see this red patch is really everywhere. A lot of citizens have it. In fact, the majority in some neighborhoods in Montreal, the majority of the citizens wear the red patch. There are red flags on a lot of buildings. Red flags are painted on the walls everywhere. It's really a beautiful ambience here in Montreal.
We only have about 30 seconds, but where does this protest go from here? It's been going on for 100 days. 400,000 people in the street, 1,000 arrests just this week. Then you have resignations. The head of the cabinet of ministers in Quebec has resigned. What do you see happening next?
I call on the unions to join forces. It's a time for a social strike. There needs to be more and more people, more movements involved in this struggle. We need to support the students.
And for my part, I think our big challenge will be to be able to continue the mobilizing throughout the summer, because a lot of students are going to go back to their homes in the region. So I think our objective will be to continue to be mobilized all through the summer. Our plan is to hold new general assemblies to get strike mandates at the beginning of August, when the winter semester will start up again. So we hope that we'll continue this fight when our semesters begin at the beginning of August. And like my colleague said, I think that now, if we want to go through the summer with our mobilization, I think the ball is in the hands of the unions, of the big social movements, in order to help us to get to have a citizen mobilization.
And to destitute Jean Charest and this government.
Yeah, well, that's the best objective that we can reach.
So I guess the question is, will the maple spring become a maple summer? I want to thank you both for being with us. Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, spokesperson
thank
for
you.
CLASS, the main coalition of student unions in the student strikes in Quebec, and Anna Krasinski, assistant professor of the School of Community and Public Affairs at Concordia University in Montreal, member of Professors Against the Hike. We're going to continue with education back in the United States in Philadelphia, where one of the largest privatization plans are underway. Stay with us.
Thank you to Democracy Now! For that interview with Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois and Anna Krasinski. For more international headlines, we go now to Democracy Now! Once again for their headlines on May 25th.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The owner of Japan's crippled Fukushima nuclear plant has admitted the amount of radioactive materials released in the first days of the nuclear disaster was almost 2.5 times the initial estimate by Japanese safety regulators. The company TEPCO said the nuclear accident released far more iodine-131 than previously estimated. The radioactive substance can cause thyroid cancer. Based on TEPCO's current figures, the Fukushima disaster represented about 17% of the radiation from the 1986 Chernobyl accident. Preliminary election results from Egypt's first-ever competitive presidential election show Muslim Brotherhood candidate Mohamed Morsi in the lead in the first round of voting. It's still unclear who he'll face off in the runoff schedule for June 16th, but it may be Ahmed Shafik, the last prime minister under ousted dictator Hosni Mubarak. Some Egyptians predicted another revolution would take place if Shafik managed to win the election.
Regardless, the results are not in Shafiq's favor. Even if the military council tries to impose Ahmed Shafik, then the revolution will begin all over again. The 25th of January revolution will begin again. And let me tell you with certainty that if they announce that Ahmed Shafik is the president of Egypt, Tahrir Square will erupt.
We'll have more on Egypt after headlines. A new report by the United Nations has found both sides in the Syrian conflict have committed serious human rights abuses. The UN accused government forces of executing entire families in their homes while anti-government rebels had tortured and killed soldiers and government supporters. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports the Obama administration's moving towards approving the transfer of arms from Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations to some Syrian rebels. In the latest on the economic crisis in Europe, one of Spain's largest banks, Bankia, is seeking a massive government bailout, reportedly worth $19 billion. Trading of the bank's shares was suspended earlier today. Meanwhile, in Greece, the latest poll shows the anti-bailout leftist Syriza party remains in the lead ahead of the June 17th election. The Syriza party is led by Alexis Tsipras.
Το δίλημα της εκλογικής αναμέτρησης που έρχεται.
The dilemma of the upcoming election, the true dilemma of the election is this: bailout or dignity.
Ή αξιοπρέπεια.
And we say to the Greek people, we say it loud so that people in all of Europe can hear. We say it loud so that the leaders of Europe can hear it. That no people can be led voluntarily to indignity, subjection, and suicide.
In business news, questions have arisen over the role of banking giants Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase in Facebook's initial public offering last week. While both banks helped manage the IPO, they also reportedly helped hedge funds bet that the new stock would fall through a process known as shorting. Investors who shorted Facebook made millions as the company's value dropped 11% Monday and a further 9% Tuesday before rebounding. In media news, USA Today has revealed the co-owner of a major Pentagon propaganda contractor has publicly admitted he was behind a propaganda campaign to discredit two USA Today journalists. The journalists were targeted after they reported the Pentagon had spent millions of dollars on, quote, poorly tracked marketing and propaganda campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan. One firm cited in the report was Leone Industries, which has received at least $120 million in Pentagon contracts since 2009. On Thursday, Leone's co-owner, Camille Chidiac, admitted he set up fake web addresses, Twitter and Facebook accounts in the names of USA Today editor Ray Locker and reporter Tom Vandenbroek as part of an online misinformation campaign. The Senate Armed Services Committee voted Thursday to cut an additional $33 million in military aid to Pakistan. The vote came in response to the 33-year jail sentence given to Shaquille Afridi, the Pakistani doctor who worked with the CIA to set up a fake vaccination program in an effort to help locate Osama bin Laden. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton defended the doctor on Thursday.
We are raising it, and we will continue to do so because we think that his treatment is unjust and unwarranted. As I've said before, the United States does not believe there is any basis for holding Dr. Afridi. We regret both the fact that he was convicted and the severity of his sentence.
In a report, Amnesty International has accused Mexican authorities of doing little to stop or prosecute widespread human rights abuses, including vicious attacks on journalists and violations by members of the military. Widespread violence against women and the systematic inequality faced by indigenous people were also mentioned in the report. The group also noted the plight of tens of thousands of migrants who pass through Mexico on their way to the United States and suffer from abuses including rape, kidnapping, and murder. Tens of thousands of people have died in Mexico in drug-related violence since President Felipe Calderon announced a crackdown on drug traffickers after taking office in 2006. Mexican journalist San Juana Martinez condemned Calderon's administration.
It's a dark period. Mexico is currently going through one of its darkest periods in terms of human rights. The administration of Felipe Calderon has been the administration of the dead. It left us a bloody Mexico, a Mexico that suffers from the consequences. There is great necessity to create a truth commission to examine what happened during this ominous period.
The Southern Poverty Law Center has included three prominent anti-Muslim activists and writers in their list of 30 new activists heading up the radical right. The list includes Frank Gaffney, head of the Center for Security Policy, David Yerushalmi, founder of the Society of Americans for National Existence, and Pamela Geller, who's called Islam, quote, the most anti-Semitic genocidal ideology in the world. The Southern Poverty Law Center also noted in the report that so-called patriot hate groups opposed to the federal government have grown explosively in recent years, while anti-LGBTQ groups have grown highly vicious in their propaganda. Amazon's announced it'll drop out of the American Legislative Exchange Council, a conservative legislative group with ties to the Koch brothers. ALEC has come under intense criticism for promoting restrictive voter ID laws and the so-called Stand Your Ground self-defense law. Reproductive rights advocates are condemning the actions of airline employees who barred a woman from her flight and demanded she change her T-shirt because it bore a pro-choice message they deemed offensive. The shirt read, "If I wanted the government in my womb, I'd bleep a senator." It was the same message on a sign held by Oklahoma State Senator Judy McIntyre at a rally in March. The woman, who's not been identified publicly, told the website RH Reality Check she was approached by an American Airlines flight attendant before landing and told the shirt was offensive and she would need to speak to the captain. The captain then told her she would have to change her shirt before boarding her connecting flight. The woman was forced to miss her connection, then allowed to board a later flight after covering her shirt with a shawl. Nearly 4,000 people have signed an online petition calling for American Airlines to apologize. And finally, a coalition of journalists and media organizations filed a petition Thursday in an attempt to grant the public and press access to more information about the court-martial of accused Army whistleblower Bradley Manning. So far, the military court has refused to make public the government's motion papers, the court's own orders, and transcripts of proceedings. Petitioners include the Center for Constitutional Rights, The Nation magazine, Glenn Greenwald, Jeremy Scahill, and Democracy Now! And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Democracy Now!'s Aaron Maté.
And thank you to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! For those headlines. More headlines can be found at democracynow.org.
And that's our program for Monday, May 28th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show was produced with expertise by CJ. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned right now for Sore Throats Clapping Hands, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.